The year is 1928, and although things do happen that year, it may be most notable as a year in which not a lot of memorable things happen. With the exception of Alexander Fleming's literally life-changing discovery of penicillin. Otherwise, the Roaring Twenties roll on as the post-war prosperity continues to make life more comfortable for growing numbers of people around the world, and the psychological theories of Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung move more firmly into the mainstream, prompting even average folks to think about the lines between their inner and outer lives. And in that year of 1928, the Pulitzer Prize for Drama went to Strange Interlude, an ambitious and highly experimental drama that touched on such taboo topics as sexual promiscuity, hereditary insanity, and abortion. It also marked the third time in less than a decade that Eugene O'Neill would win the Pulitzer Prize. My name is Jan Simpson. Welcome to All the Drama, a podcast about the plays and musicals that have won American theater's highest accolade, the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. This episode marks the third anniversary of All the Drama, and as I've done in the past 2 years, I'm celebrating by devoting this anniversary episode to one of the four plays by Eugene O'Neill that won the Pulitzer Prize. I gave a full rundown of O'Neill's early years in the episode on his first Pulitzer winner, Beyond the Horizon, so I'm only going to highlight some of the major events in his life now. O'Neill was born on October 16, 1888, to the celebrated actor James O'Neill and his wife, Mary Ellen. Young Gene spent his boyhood in boarding schools, while his parents traveled around the country with his father's acting company. He went to Princeton, but dropped out after a year, and then spent most of his early 20s working as a seaman and developing a serious drinking problem that, in one way or another, would plague him for the rest of his life. But O'Neill did manage to make his way into George Pierce Baker's pioneering playwriting course at Harvard. However, he really came into his own as a writer when he hooked up with the Provincetown Players, a group of artists, writers, and activists determined to create in this country the kind of serious theater that Strindberg, Ibsen, and Chekhov had introduced in Europe. O'Neill quickly became the Players' leading dramatist and the most important an influential playwright in America. Within a decade, he produced such plays as Beyond the Horizon, Anna Christie, The Emperor Jones, The Hairy Ape, and Desire Under the Elms. And so, as he was approaching 40 in 1928, O'Neill was by every measure a success. He was the subject of countless articles and a full biography. Yale awarded him an honorary degree for advancing the art of theater. Meanwhile, he and his second wife, Agnes, had two children, a son, Shane, and a daughter, Una. And after years of living from pillar to post, the O'Neills were even financially secure enough to buy a second home in Bermuda. But O'Neill was growing unhappy with the work that he was turning out. "When I first have an idea," he told a friend, "it is a blazing fire. When I have written it, it is glowing coals. When it is rehearsed and acted, it is warm embers. When an audience sees it, it is ashes." He said that what he really wanted to do was to revive the old theatrical approaches to drama that had made the works of Shakespeare and the playwrights of ancient Greece so great, essential, and lasting. So, in 1925, he worked on The Great God Brown, a somewhat conventional love triangle that took the unconventional approach of requiring some of the actors to wear masks similar to the ones the Greeks had used. He worried that the experiment might alienate the critics, but they welcomed his ambitiousness and the public did too. The play opened in January 1926 and ran for an impressive 276 performances. The O'Neills used some of the money the show brought in to buy yet another home, a two-story log cabin in a village in Maine that was about 10 miles north of Augusta. O'Neill, who had been sober for nearly a year then, liked the fact that being there kept him away from his old drinking buddies. He swam and fished when he wasn't writing. It was there that he began working on a play based on an idea that had come to him a few years earlier about a woman mourning for a husband who had died in World War I. As he developed the idea, the play formed around a woman named Nina Leeds, whose grief over a fiancé lost in the war dominates the rest of her life and those of the three men who fall in love with her. O'Neill also wanted to find a way to reveal his character's inner thoughts. He decided to adapt the soliloquies that Shakespeare had used, but, influenced by the modernist ideas that were popping up in works by other artists of the day like James Joyce and Virginia Woolf, he wrote his monologues in a stream of consciousness style, so that a character reflecting in one sentence on the death of a close friend might wonder in the next sentence what time of day it is or when lunch might be served. He tried out different titles for the play, but the one that stuck was Strange Interlude. It borrowed from a line in which Nina says, "Our lives are merely strange interludes in the electrical display of God the Father." But it also references the way that the soliloquies, O'Neill called them asides, create little discursions in the narrative of the play. By the time he was finished, the asides took up more than two-thirds of the script, and, according to his biographer, Robert M. Dowling, O'Neill was so proud of the outcome that he worried someone else might steal his idea before the play was produced. And so, although he had been angry with the Theater Guild for rejecting some of his previous plays, he agreed to the Guild's offer to produce Strange Interlude. The play opened on January 30th, 1928, with Lynn Fontaine as Nina. O'Neill's stage directions for the play were extremely specific, but the director, Philip Moeller, still had to figure out how to stage the asides. He settled on having the other actors on stage freeze in place whenever one of the characters delivered one of those monologues. The play was, in essence, kind of a melodrama, as Nina bounces between the three men, aborts one child, conceives another with a lover while married to someone else, and later develops a slightly incestuous attraction to her grown son. But the fun was seeing the difference between what the characters said to one another and what they were really thinking. But that took time, and the play, which unspools over 40 years and 9 acts, ran for over 5 hours. So the curtain time for that original production was 5:15. Then there was a break for dinner at 7:40, with the play resuming at 9 and ending sometime around 11. The critics were divided on it, with passionate advocates on one side, passionate detractors on the other side, and lots of debating about whether Strange Interlude was the greatest play ever produced in America to that point, or just a very long, very pretentious, and very boring evening in the theater. All that talk caused theatergoers to flock to the John Golden Theater to see the show for themselves. It ended up running for 426 performances. The desire to see Strange Interlude was so intense that some people even bought standing room only tickets and stood for the full 5+ hours. The response delighted O'Neill, although he joked that he wouldn't have stood that long to see the original production of The Crucifixion. The interest in Strange Interlude also spread across the country, and a touring company went out while the play was still running on Broadway. Groucho Marx even parodied the play's soliloquies in the classic 1930 Marx Brothers comedy Animal Crackers. And lots of people got the joke. But the play's sexual themes still caused it to be banned in many cities, including Boston, whose mayor called Strange Interlude disgusting. Seizing the opportunity to show how progressive his city was, the mayor of nearby Quincy invited the production there, and it said that so many theatergoers discovered and enjoyed the local Quincy restaurant Howard Johnson's during the play's dinner break that the owners of Howard Johnson's decided to open up additional places outside the city, which eventually led to that restaurant empire. In 1932, MGM did a trimmed-down movie version of the play with Norma Shearer and Clark Gable. It was only 5 years after the jazz singer had introduced talking movies to the public, and many of the actors in the film version of Strange Interlude relied on the old silent movie gestures, widening their eyes and staring into the distance as they delivered the asides. O'Neill hated the movie, and he was right, it is pretty bad. But his biographer Robert M. Dowling estimated that all totaled, Strange Interlude ultimately earned O'Neill $250,000, which would be close to $5 million today. When O'Neill won the Pulitzer, he graciously donated its $1,000 in prize money to the Actors Fund. Far more valuable to O'Neill was the fact that the play put him on an equal footing with the major European playwrights of the day. The Nobel Prize Committee added him to their shortlist of contenders for the Nobel in Literature. O'Neill would win that prize in 1936, and he remained the only American playwright to have done so. But Strange Interlude hasn't been an easy show to revive. The great O'Neill interpreter Jose Quintero tried to do it in 1963 with Geraldine Page as Nina and Pat Hingle, Rip Torn, and William Prince as the three men in her life. That cast also included a young Jane Fonda, but the production only managed to run 97 performances. Similarly, a 1985 production with Glenda Jackson as Nina ran only 63 performances, although that version was adapted for television, and you can find bits of it on YouTube. Some more recent productions, including one in 2012 at Washington, D.C.'s Shakespeare Theater Company, have cut the play down to 3 hours or so, and have tried to play the melodrama and the asides for laughs. But the most ambitious production is certainly the one in 2017, in which the New York downtown actor David Greenspan did the entire 5.5-hour script and played all the parts himself. Joining me to talk about Strange Interlude is Ron Quirk, who is a little different from guests we've had before, because although Ron is a member of the Eugene O'Neill Society and the organizer of the monthly meetup discussion group, Eugene O'Neill, Drama, Self-Understanding, and Fun, he is first and foremost an O'Neill fan. And you might say that he's a super fan of Strange Interlude, a play that has a very personal meaning for him. Hello, Ron Quirk. Welcome to All the Drama.
Yes, thank you, Jan. Very happy to be here.
I'm going to start off by asking you how you first encountered Eugene O'Neill's work and what drew you to it.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think it's a bit of a coincidence that we're talking about Strange Interlude today, because It was this play that first piqued my interest in O'Neill. It's a very personal story, too, and I've shared it with a number of people, so I'll be happy to share it with you, too. Basically, until 2013, when I was in my mid-50s, I virtually had no knowledge of O'Neill, and it took a major psychological crisis to introduce me to his work. In the 2012-2013 period, I inexplicably developed panic disorder, very, very bad panic disorder. It was very unsettling. I didn't know what it was, and I couldn't find any answers to my problem. You know, nobody I knew could understand what was going on. They tended to avoid me, and I was also seeing a pretty bad therapist, which only made things worse. But in 2013, I happened to see the 1932 version of Strange Interlude with Norma Shearer and Clark Gable on Turner Classic Movies. Mm-hmm. And I was very intrigued by the voiceover technique and the pre-code treatment of controversial topics such as infidelity, abortion, mental illness, and eugenics. And I was thinking to myself, who is this guy? You know, I'd like to investigate it further. So after I saw that film, I started reading virtually all of O'Neill's plays in chronological order. And what struck me was the sheer emotional intelligence that basically leapt off the pages when I read those plays. And it was just what I needed to improve my situation. His plays spoke to me on many levels because they presented human beings as tragic figures, but without judgment. You know, in O'Neill's world, there are flawed human beings, but there's no heroes or villains, just people doing the best they can with what they have and dealing with the stumbling blocks they inherited from their families and their social circles. So I was intrigued enough to finish the entire O'Neill canon in about 3 months.
Wow.
And yeah, and basically, you know, in sum, with this particular topic, O'Neill's insights were very therapeutic.
Wow, that is fascinating. Having read all of Eugene O'Neill's works, and that's not easy, he wrote a lot of stuff. Where would you place Strange Interlude in your list of his works? Taking aside that it was your first introduction, and obviously you have a particular emotional connection to it, but in terms of perhaps the literary quality of his work.
Oh my goodness, I love it. It's in my top three O'Neill plays, and I think it was well-deserved, a Pulitzer. But, you know, I think that, and I'll use some scholarly research on this to sort of explain this. As you probably know, O'Neill referred to Strange Interlude as his woman play, right? And Travis Bogart, who is one of the premier O'Neill scholars, pointed out that the men in the play are defined only by their relationships with the protagonist, Nina Leeds. But at the same time, Nina has no life beyond the men. And I think that this is a perfect encapsulation of a lot of the themes in O'Neill's plays, because O'Neill was a pretty Oedipal playwright. Let's just take Long Day's Journey, right? Long Day's Journey and Tonight. In that play, you know, the lives of the three men all revolved around Mary Tyrone, the mother. And in turn, she lives only for them. You know, in the famous words in Long Day's Journey was that she had met her husband and she was happy for a while. In this play, I believe it was Ned Darrell, the doctor, who said that I was happy for a while with my relationship with Nina. And then there's a lot of other O'Neill plays that have a very strong woman with men sort of revolving around them. I mean, I think of Anna Christie, for example, right? And More Stately Mansions, A Moon for the Misbegotten, and Desire Under the Elms. I think those were all very, very strong woman plays, and the woman protagonist did what she basically wanted to do while the men thought they were running the show, but they weren't. And I just also wanted to mention that O'Neill often struggled with his religious faith, as you probably know, right? So if you have, just indulge me to quote this particular observation. Nina said, "The mistake began when God was created in a male image. Of course, women would love to see him that way, but men should have been gentlemen enough, remembering their mothers, to make God a woman. But the God of gods, the boss, has always been a man. That makes life so perverted and death so unnatural. We should have imagined life is created in the birth pain of God the mother. Then we would understand why we, her children, have inherited pain. for we would know that our life's rhythm beats from her great heart, torn with the agony of love and birth, and we would feel that death meant reunion with her, a passing back into her substance, blood of her blood again, peace of her peace. Wouldn't that be more logical and satisfying than having a god, a man whose chest thunders with egotism and it is too hard for tired heads and thoroughly comfortless people? Isn't that perfect?
I can see how much you enjoy this play. You can hear it. Have you ever seen a production?
Sadly, I have not. Just the movie. And you know, after I read the play, I watched the movie again, and I saw that it was just sort of a pale shadow of it. But how are you going to fit 9 acts into 2 hours, right? They probably did the best they could under the circumstances, right?
I have to confess, I didn't like the movie. I just, when they stop and stare into the distance,
yes,
to deliver what O'Neill calls the asides, the soliloquies or monologues, it just didn't quite work for me. It didn't quite work for him either.
No, it did not. I don't think he liked it. And I agree with you 10,000%, Jan, on that one. In the movie's defense, though, if you see a lot of those early talkies, a lot of the actors really didn't know their lines, right? So they were always staring off, looking for direction, right?
You're an O'Neill defender. You're an O'Neill man. Why do you think the Pulitzer Board awarded the prize to this specific play? Even for someone like you who loves the play, I think you will admit it's kind of an odd play.
It is indeed. As far as I can see, the committee likes plays that reflect the zeitgeist of American society in a very unique way, a deep way. And Strange Interlude certainly does reflect a number of themes in 1920s America. You know, one aspect of the play that I think has gotten short shrift, and I may have missed some articles on this, but it's the eugenics. As you probably know, the eugenics movement was going pretty strong in America in the 1920s, right? And Strange Interlude has eugenics stamped all over it. I think the theater scholar Tamsin Wolfe sums it up pretty well. He says, O'Neill sets up and then repeatedly questions a powerful social myth of good and bad bloodlines in Strange Interlude. And I would add to that if you note in towards the end of the play, after Daryl had gotten over Nina, his obsession with Nina, he tells her that he is through meddling with human lives and will stick to his research on one cell to animals. So I think that eugenics is a strong, you know, theme in the play.
But are you saying that the board was validating eugenics?
No. It's like as Tamsin Wolfe said, O'Neill sets up and then repeatedly questions the powerful social myth of good and bad bloodlines in Strange Interlude. So no, I think O'Neill was satirizing eugenics basically in this play.
I think the play is probably though best known for the experimental monologues, again, that O'Neill called,
yes,
asides. Did O'Neill use this approach much after this play? It doesn't seem so.
He tried to use it in the next play, Dynamo. And when the play was produced, O'Neill was overseas. And I think it was the only play that he didn't micromanage the direction of. So unlike in Strange Interlude, where the asides were used to reveal their hidden feelings, in Dynamo, it's basically they just repeated what their asides were, right? So it didn't work at all. O'Neill was very upset about what he read about. I don't think he even saw the play produced. It only lasted 50 performances. He rewrote the play and he took the asides out.
Well, I think most people today looking at the play, reading the play, would say that it's a bit melodramatic. There are so many secrets and love affairs. Mm-hmm. A lot of O'Neill's works, and certainly the big plays that he wrote at the end of his life, are revived and done regularly. This one isn't. And I wonder, can it play today, or is it too maybe campy?
Oh, you know, that's a really interesting question, Jan. I appreciate you bringing that up. you know, to get to your point about the melodrama, I think that if this play was done right and emphasized, you know, the fact that the what everybody's thinking in the play, you know, with their asides, that's their primal nature, right? And then, of course, they hide it behind the persona, and they, you know, act in ways that are socially appropriate. But at the same time, they have these very primal themes going through their minds, as we all do, you know. And that, I think, is in a way is sort of the antithesis of melodrama, because usually in melodrama, it's just people acting out and they get overly emotional and they go from one relationship to another, but they don't think. It's just like unthinking, right? In this play, there's if it's done right, director could emphasize the asides, and I'm not a director, obviously, but there could be a way that the asides could be used to, you know, relate to primal nature just as universal themes, and maybe the persona could be updated, but the same primal thoughts are still there. So I think that this could be done today, but I think the length might be a problem, you know, because, right, 9 acts, that would be a challenge for a, you know, production company to put on, wouldn't it?
Certainly would. It's an interesting play for many reasons, but one of them is that it's the third of O'Neill's plays to win the Pulitzer. But among the four, Beyond the Horizon, Anna Christie, and Long Day's Journey, it's the least known. And so I want to thank you for taking the time to help acquaint our listeners a little bit with this lesser known, but still very significant Eugene O'Neill Pulitzer Prize winner. So thanks, Ron.
Jan, thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss this. I mean, I'm very honored to be on your podcast here. I really am. And maybe if some people take an interest in the play because of this, you know, that would be very gratifying. So thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. I hope you'll come back next time. And if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, please send them to me at jan@broadwayradio.com.